Welcome to the Hashtag Health Podcast. My name is Andrew. I will be your host for this two-part series on confronting surgical weight delays, where we will look at the ways forward to improve the timeliness of elective surgical care in Ontario. Whether you've seen it in the news, heard the stories from a friend or family member, or are experiencing it yourself, there are many Canadians waiting in a seemingly never-ending line for elective surgical care. As of winter 2023, there are over 200,000 Ontarians estimated to be waiting for an elective surgical procedure. The COVID-19 crisis has had many detrimental impacts on our everyday life and our healthcare system, including the cancellation and postponement of many elective surgical procedures. The pandemic has definitely exacerbated this issue and put it into the spotlight of national media attention. But these problems have existed in our system long before the pandemic. Even before the start of the pandemic, approximately one out of every five Canadians waited more than 4 months for an elective surgical procedure, which is amongst the highest wait times for developed countries. Canadians have been and continue to wait a long time for elective surgical care. It is pretty clear that change and improvements need to be made. Even though we call these surgeries elective, they can have an enormous impact on the quality of life for patients. There have been many ideas and proposals on how we can improve the delivery of surgical care so that patients are waiting less for surgery. Here in Ontario, there has been a recent push from the provincial government to turn to the private sector to help perform elective surgeries. The idea behind this being it takes away some of the volume of patients waiting in our public healthcare system. While this idea is still in the early phases here in Ontario, there are examples across the globe with two-tier healthcare, which come with variable impacts on surgical wait times. Alternatively, ambulatory or community surgery centers that remain part of our public healthcare system offer another solution. The principle behind this is to have streamlined and cost-efficient operating rooms that handle lower-risk elective surgical procedures where patients are often discharged the same day. There are multiple examples of these centers already operating here in Ontario, including the Nazem Kadri Surgical Center in London, Ontario. Other experts are advocating for strengthening our current public healthcare system by redesigning how we use our resources and deliver care. These include team-based models of surgical care and centralized referral systems, where patients are referred into a single common queue for a certain procedure that multiple surgeons in a geographic region could perform so that the next available surgeon can see the patient who is next in line. This brings us to today's guest. To help us understand the intricacies of surgical wait times and the possible ways forward to improve the timeliness of surgical care, we are very excited to welcome our guest, Dr. David Kerbach, the head of the Department of Surgery at Women's College Hospital in Toronto and professor at the University of Toronto in the Departments of Surgery and Health Policy Management and Evaluation. While much of our discussion emphasizes the state of surgical wait times here in Ontario, the ideas we discuss may have broader application as we focus today's discussion on how we can reorganize our resources in the public healthcare system to deliver care in a more timely manner. All right, Dr. Kerbach, welcome to the show. Why don't we start with a little introduction of yourself, including some of the clinical roles you hold and some of the non-clinical roles that you also have.
Great. So thank you. Thanks for the invitation. My name is David Kerbach. I'm a general surgeon in terms of my clinical role. So I work in downtown Toronto in a teaching hospital. My clinical practice is mostly, some general surgery like hernia, gallbladder, that type of stuff. And then I do have special interests in some specialty areas of surgery, including bariatric surgery. So surgery for obesity. I also do a lot of spleen and adrenal surgery for various different types of diseases. So that's my clinical background. And I should say I also take emergency call and do emergency acute care general surgery. I do have some non-clinical roles. So I am head of a department of surgery at Women's College Hospital in Toronto. I'm a professor at the University of Toronto in the Department of Surgery, as well as health policy management and evaluation. So I am involved in organizing, coordinating surgical services within hospitals. I sit on committees for Ontario Health to try and organize and improve the delivery of surgery in the province. And I also do research. So I'm a scientist. I do health services research And my area of interest really relates to access to care, to health services in the Canadian health setting, and ways that we can actually improve the access that people do have to health services.
Over the last few years, we've been hearing a lot about how the surgical wait list and now the backlog that we have with some of the cancellations of surgeries during COVID has become a problem in Ontario. So I'm wondering, how has this backlog and the increased surgery wait times affected your practice and the patients that you see?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think you're going to find the answer surprising, but I think the answer is also very telling about the nature of the problem. So I'm just going to tell you very simply, from my perspective, it's really had no impact on my clinical practice. So generally, patients are referred to me in my general surgery practice. I generally see them within like a week or two of referral to do a consultation. And if they need surgery, and it's important to remember, I do very elective surgery, like hernia repairs. Gallbladder surgery, by and large, is not emergency surgery. Certainly, you know, surgery for morbid obesity is not. And we schedule surgery within usually about 6 to 8 weeks. I'm in downtown Toronto. It's got its own micro ecosystem. But looking across the province, that is not the story of surgery or general surgery everywhere. But it's the reason I say it's telling is because what I'm going to, you know, hopefully persuade you of is that the problem in Ontario or in Canada is not so much that everyone's waiting too long or that there's this wait list that's just too long and people don't have access. It's that the lack of coordination in our system, so the lack of any relationship between what one surgeon is doing and another surgeon is doing, either next door to them in the same hospital, in a different hospital across the street, or in a different city in the province, there's no relationship. So my maybe disappointing answer to your question is it's had no impact whatsoever on me. We see patients and operate on them quickly. And that's kind of the way it's always been, but that's just due to where I sit in my little microcosm of the system. Overall, if you try and answer the question, what's happened to the health system, there's probably a different answer overall. There's a big caveat, which is we really don't know because the data we have on this are really not very good. But one thing we do know is that at a period of time that there would have been a certain number of operations happening in the province, there were not. And the gap between what would have been done, and this is during pockets of time in 2021, 2022, the gap was never made up. So the missing operations that weren't done in like the spring of 2020 and in other waves when there were hospital slowdowns, there was never a surge and an overcompensation. So it certainly makes sense that there due to this sort of underperformance across the system, that this would have accentuated pre-existing backlogs. But there's no single source of truth on waits for surgery because there's no central repository right now for waits for surgery. We do have wait time data that's reported to the province, but it's usually reported at the time that people have surgery. So once, you know, say I operate on someone, I fix their hernia, then at that point we enter in the dates, the date that the surgery happened, the date that the decision, like this is a retrospective date, the date that the decision to have surgery was made a month ago, 2 months ago, and the date that the patient was referred to see me and the date that I saw the patient. So all these wait time data points are occur, they're entered into systems at the time when someone actually received their care. So upstream of that, to know what's happening with the 100,000 or 50,000 or 200,000 or million, whatever it is of people, we don't know them. We can't identify them because they're not actually on a list. So it's a difficult question to answer. To the extent that we're getting better data, it does look like it's had an impact in the province, but it's really particular to certain clinical areas. So some areas have largely been completely unaffected. So cancer care has largely been unaffected. We've always been able to deliver cancer surgery services, other urgent surgery, emergency surgery, transplant, cardiac, vascular, urgent types of operations. And this is a bit of a theme in the Canadian health system. We're always good in the acute setting in that if you walk into a hospital emergency department off the street with a catastrophic illness, you'll get the best care on planet Earth. The shortcoming of the system often is what to do with patients who need primary care, longitudinal care, referral for nuisance problem, what to do with an arthritic hip who might need a joint replacement. So these are where the system falls short. But so just setting aside my personal experience, which is not going to be representative of certainly what you might expect to see in the media, but there almost certainly was an exacerbation of pre-existing weights. And it's somewhere, you know, between, 20%, 25% or so extra patients who are still on these expanded wait lists. Knowing that nobody actually knows, like no individual is identified as part of a backlog, what it just means is that, you know, a wait for something like a total knee replacement that in 2019 for a certain surgeon might have been 9 months, say, or 5 months or something, may now look, instead of 9 months, it may look like 11 months or 13 months or something. But again, all these wait time data that we don't have dynamic real-time data on people who are still awaiting appointments, still awaiting surgeries. Wait times are artifacts, like the wait times that we see that are reported are artifacts because they're reported and they're historically interpreted. And what the correct way to interpret wait time data, at least in Ontario, is that, the median wait time is, this is like the median, like the 50th percentile of all the people who happen to have waited for surgery in a certain period of time and have now had surgery, the median wait for this type of surgery was this month, 4.2 months. So it's all in retrospect, and it's very difficult to actually tell what's happening dynamically in the system based on the way the data sort of enters the wait times databases.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like the way that we record and report data here in Ontario definitely makes it a bit challenging to interpret what this all means. I know in your research, you focus a lot on improving access to surgical care by reorganizing how we deliver care. You advocate for team-based care models or shared care models and also a centralized referral system for surgical care. I'm wondering, what do these models actually entail? Like, how do they work? And what are some of the advantages of having these models?
Right. So, and in general, the approach that I, the types of things that I advocate are things that improve the coordination of care. Just to take a quick step back, the things that explain problems with access or backlog or wait times, basically everything you can explain on the basis of supply of services. So this is like how many hospitals, how many operating rooms, nurses, funding, staffing, like how many operations we can do. So you got supply on the one side, and then there's demand on the other side. So the demands are patients who need surgery, who want surgery, who believe they need surgery, may not actually need surgery, but they're on a wait list for surgery. It's a whole universe with the intersecting Venn diagram. So there's the supply of services, demand for services. And generally in a perfect system that's highly efficient, like in a utopian model where everyone goes to the right place all the time, then supply and demand themselves would explain everything. And if you increase supply, with a fixed demand, then the access will improve, like the wait times will go down. If you decrease supply, wait times will increase. So supply and demand are important, but the problem is we don't have a utopian, perfect, efficient system. We don't have a transparent marketplace. Like what we have is a model, at least in surgery for the most part, where individual surgeons all operate their own small business. And there's no transparency, they just operate it themselves. So they're referred patients directly by direct physician referral. So that means a primary care physician or some other physician doctor will make a referral to see a specialist, not just surgeons, but most specialists can work this way. And that's point to point, person to person. And the specialist they're referring to hopefully is the right specialist. Often it is, not always. But the referring doctor really has no idea when they're referring to a specialist, like, well, how long will this patient wait for the appointment? And if they're a surgeon, well, how long will they wait after the appointment? If they need surgery, how much longer is it actually going to take a surgery? So there's most of this information isn't really readily available. And what I can tell you based on our research is it's hugely variable. So there are surgeons around the province who can see patients very quickly in their office and can operate on them very quickly. There are surgeons who can see patients quickly, but then can't operate them on them for a year and a half. There are patients who can't see a patient for 9 months, but then they'll operate on them the next week. And there's surgeons who can't see a patient for a year and then can't operate on them for a year. So it's just all because of this highly independent and siloed way that the system actually functions. It's the way that it evolved. I'm not here to say it's good, it's bad, it's correct, it's wrong, whatever. It is what it is. And it started based on sort of the healthcare marketplaces that just evolved as, you know, people built practices for decades and decades. A lot of healthcare has become a lot more coordinated and organized and interdependent and complex, but this fundamental model of a surgeon owning their own practice is still, there's a bit of a historical curiosity. But that whole segue about the setup and how patients flow to individual surgeons, the reason I'm talking about that is because what that speaks to is the coordination and how supply is matched to the demand. So right now, there's no way to ensure that there's an efficient matching of supply to demand. So what happens is it's driven by the marketplace, which is not transparent, and there's no drivers to ensure efficiency. So what I advocate for, and this is, I guess I started answering your question, was for things that improve coordination. So, and those are things like team-based models of care where surgeons are less working in their own independent private businesses, but they're joining a group in some way. The intensity or the extent of group participation can vary. The simplest form is just to do something called a shared intake. So people often call these models single entry models or central intake or centralized triage. But basically what it means is instead of a family doctor who encounters a patient with, say, a hernia, deciding that, okay, I want to send that patient to see Dr. Urbach, they don't. They send them to a downtown Toronto hernia queue where they're seen by the next available surgeon who sees this type of problem. So that's sort of the simplest approach to sign up any type of group or team-based model of care, but it can become more extensive. And at the extreme, you can have surgeons working together in team-based care, just as a lot of other healthcare providers do in our complex and modern health system. So, you know, when you go to medicine, inpatient medicine is often team-based medicine. So there's a whole team. There's often allied health providers. Every week, the team may change. There may be a new attending staff physician who's responsible, but they just take over from their colleague. They're not direct referrals to a specific doctor. Someone sort of inherits the whole program or the team. There may be, you know, residents, other learners, medical students, et cetera, on the team. They come and go, but the team is the constant. So at the extreme, surgery can work that way as well. And it's, there are instances where it does actually work that way. So I work as part of a model up here called the Ontario Bariatric Network. So I said I do surgery for obesity. And that is a centralized program administered centrally in the province in Ontario. You can't get a publicly insured surgery for obesity except through this thing called the Ontario Bariatric Network. You're referred to a center of excellence based on your residence in the province, postal code. Once that referral comes in our center at the Toronto Western Hospital, patients are just triaged to the next available provider, whether it's a dietitian, a social worker, a psychologist, a nurse practitioner, whatever. They just see the next available provider on the team. If it's a surgeon they need to see, they see the next available. So we just go and as a surgeon, I'll go and staff a clinic. I'll see a whole bunch of patients. I'll write my notes. I'll examine them. I'll do everything I need to do. And then I leave the clinic at the end of the day. But the patients belong to the program. They don't belong to me. And then I also do surgery as part of the program. If I'm scheduled to do surgery, patients are also scheduled always for the next available appointment. They don't have to wait to work around my schedule. They just get scheduled next available. And if it's my day, I go and I do the operations and I meet them before if I've never seen them before. And as you might imagine, there's this particular program has four surgeons. So there's at least a 75% chance that one of my partners would have seen them preoperatively. But the patients understand they get a very good quality of care and a very good care experience. And the brand of the program is very reassuring to people, and they expect to receive good care. They're not worried that, oh, they had to find the right doctor or the wrong doctor. And then I will do an operation on them, even if that's a patient that I manage longitudinally myself. So that's a very, I would say a more extensive shared care model where the surgeons are actually completely sharing their patients without any ownership. That's also done with surgical oncology in Ottawa, at the Ottawa Hospital. So like hepatobiliary cancer, colorectal cancer, colorectal surgery, inflammatory bowel disease is all done by surgeons who work together in teams to care for patients. And it's a highly efficient model of care. So when you move towards that, you actually start to have a picture where patients are efficiently directed to next available providers. And what that does is it doesn't necessarily solve wait time problems, because there still might be a supply or demand problem. Like you still may need more supply of services, or you may need less demand. Like you may have to say, well, maybe we don't need to be doing this particular operation and so many people, but there's ways to adjust supply and demand. But the first step is to first link supply and demand so that at least you know what the wait time is, what a real wait time is. And the only way you know what a real wait time is when everybody is in the same wait. Because if every single person is only in their own specific queue, there's no such thing as a wait time until we get to that thing that I explained that's after the fact. Historical interpretation of what a wait time for a population was, how it the distribution of all the different wait times. So, but once everyone's in the same queue, then you can look at the wait time and say, okay, well, look, everyone in the province is now waiting 4.5 months for a knee replacement. And then you can have a discussion. Then you can say, okay, is that acceptable? Is that a reasonable standard of care for residents of Ontario to wait 4.5 months for a knee replacement? If they have terrible arthritis, maybe it's 8 months, maybe it's 20 months. Whatever it is will lead you to a different conclusion. But at that point, you can say either, maybe we don't really have a problem. Like maybe 4 months is okay. It's not ideal to, to limp and have a painful knee or hip for 4 months, but maybe that's kind of what a system looks like. But at least you can sort of say, well, then we need to tinker a little bit with supply. We need to do more. If it's 20 months, most people would say, oh, that, that's too long. That's not acceptable for a modern health system in a developed country, and people kind of deserve access to care that's better. And we really have to make sure we increase the supply, and we'll do it in a way that addresses the population need. But at least you can have that conversation because people are in a common queue. So that's an efficiency rationale for why these types of models are beneficial and have advantages. The other reason I believe they have advantages is for us as surgeons. Like we emphasize a lot the benefits to patients and reducing wait times. But the truth is participation in a group model, like as a team, is much more supportive and leads to a much more positive and a healthier work life than doing everything on your own. Because a lot of the stresses that we face in health systems relate to things that we have very little control over, trying to figure out what to do with a patient who needs surgery. I have to cancel a clinic. I'm just, what could I do with all these patients? Like all these things can add up and stress individual physicians. But if you're part of a team and the management of the team is sort of centralized and you show up for work, you present, you do your professional role, you can take tremendous professional satisfaction and seeing patients, doing surgeries, making diagnoses, whatever it is you do as a doctor. But you don't inherit all of the stresses and all the complexities and all of the coordination problems of which, our lives are now just consumed more and more with these things, especially with constrained resources. So there's advantages to patients because they generally will get more equitable and faster access to care. There's benefits to surgeons. And also care becomes a little bit more reliable and standardized. A lot of people are surprised that there's variation in quality. There's variation in the use of surgical procedures. There's variation in the way procedures are done. And the more that people work together, and particularly surgeons work together and share patients and share processes, the more care becomes standardized. So reproducible, more similar, and more reliable. So it also has quality benefits. To me, there's no real downside, and there's only benefits for moving toward these more coordinated models of care.
This concludes the first part of our two-part series on managing surgical wait times in Ontario. For patients, surgeons, and family physicians, there are many advantages to reorganizing how we deliver surgical care in our current public healthcare system. As Dr. Urbach also mentions, having a centralized system to perform procedures comes with the additional benefit of being able to standardize how we interpret surgical wait time data, allowing us to make more evidence-informed decisions about if we need to increase the supply of certain surgical procedures performed in our system. Tune in next time for part two of this series, where Dr. Urbach will join us again to talk about how these solutions can be implemented here in Ontario.